During the Civil War, women were forced to adjust to life without their husbands, fathers, brothers, and sons. From Maine to Mississippi, they took control of the home front and supported their troops from there. But some took their wartime activities further, crossing enemy lines and serving as spies and soldiers in disguise. Author Karen Abbott, known as a pioneer of so-called sizzle history, has written the tales of four of these women, two from the Union and two from the Confederacy. They used their wits, guts, and guile to subvert the enemy. Liar, temptress, soldier, spy, with Karen Abbott on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanking you again for joining us. The American Civil War, the bloodiest in our nation's history, is typically thought of as an all-male endeavor, but women were actively engaged in the conflict, too. As their husbands, sons, brothers, and fathers went off to battle, women took control of the home front. They managed their families and their families' businesses. They formed aid societies. They sewed clothing. They raised money. They even served as informal recruiting officers. Some women went even further in their wartime efforts by becoming spies and soldiers. Our guest this hour is the historian and author Karen Abbott, and her new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War, tells the stories of Belle Boyd, Emma Edmondson, Rose O'Neill Greenhough, and Elizabeth Van Loo. Each of these women's narratives reads like a Hollywood screenplay, complete with love, death, despair, and triumph. Belle Boyd, a bold teenager with a passion for adventure who crossed enemy lines as a courier. Emma Edmondson, a Canadian runaway who disguised herself as a man to fight for the Union. Rose O'Neill Greenhough, who has Maryland roots, a beautiful widow who ran a spy ring. And Elizabeth Van Loo, a wealthy spinster who went undercover to help captured Northern soldiers escape. This is some cool stuff. Despite the fact that they had no vote, no straightforward access to the political system or political discourse, these four women found ways to play crucial roles in support of their sides. As I've stated, Karen Abbott is a historian and author. The book that she wrote earlier is an account of two sisters who established a brothel in Chicago in 1900. And the reviewer for USA Today decided that Karen Abbott is a pioneer of sizzle history, and that term stuck. That book is called Sin in the Second City. Another book called American Rose chronicles the life of the burlesque star Gypsy Rose Lee. Karen Abbott also is a featured contributor to Smithsonian Magazine's history blog, Past Imperfect. She's written for Disunion, which is the New York Times series, online series about the Civil War. And her book, again, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. The publisher is Harper. And it's nice to have you on the show, Karen. Thank you for joining us on Midday.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, the title. I love the title. and that's, I think of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that title comes with apologies to John Le Carré.
Yeah, it's okay.
But we wanted something that that sort of echoed that intrigue and that mystery, and also that, you know, these four words, liar, temptress, soldier, and spy, apply to each of the women, often all at once. They were each in their own ways liars, temptresses, soldiers, and spies.
You know, the Civil War was described by someone once as a monsoon of history. And it's true. I mean, there's so much to it, the scale of it, as a historian approaching this. But you plucked out of it these stories. So first of all, thank you very much for doing that. So I wonder just how did you get to it, though? What brought you to the Civil War?
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia and moved to Atlanta in 2001 and stayed there for 6 years and was immediately struck by how the Civil War is still being fought down there on a daily basis. You know, it seeps into conversation and daily life in a way it never does up north. And, you know, I had to get used to the occasional Confederate flags on the lawns and the jokes about the War of Northern Aggression. And the point was really driven home for me one day when I was stuck in traffic on 400 and I was sitting behind a pickup truck that had a bumper sticker that read, "Don't blame me, I voted for Jefferson Davis," who, of course, was the president of the Confederacy. And it just got me thinking, more in depth about the Civil War. And my mind always goes to, well, what were the women doing? And not just any women. What were the bad women doing? What were the defiant women doing? And it led me to these four lady spies.
I'm amazed by this fact, and then we can go from here. As many as 400 women posed as men and served as soldiers during the Civil War. You got that number from various estimates from various historians?
Yes, there's been some academic studies called from the records to see how many women approximately, there's no definitive count, but how many women approximately disguise themselves. And the general number is about 400 for both North and South.
I mean, That's really fascinating. I guess they went through some sort of recruitment, or they showed up at an office to sign up someplace, got a uniform. No one, whoever was in charge didn't pay much attention, or they needed the women to join up.
Well, exactly. It was one of the more interesting bits of research. The conventions dictated that doctors across the country had to conduct extensive physical examinations for soldiers. But they flouted these rules because, as you said, they needed bodies. They needed them quickly. They had quotas to fill. So basically, they only really cared if you had fingers to pull a trigger, enough teeth to rip off powder cartridges, and if you had feet to march. Their standards were pretty low. So a lot of people got passed in just, by the shake of a hand or being tapped on the chest. In Emma Edmonds' case, the doctor did merely shake her hand, and she was admitted into the Army as Private Frank Thompson.
And Frank Thompson, or Franklin Thompson, was a pretty good shot.
Oh, yes. Emma grew up in Canada and had been raised on a farm and was sort of a tomboy and was quite used to doing the chores that stereotypical chores that a boy would do. In fact, her father had always wanted boys to help out on the farm and was, disappointed every time his wife gave birth to a girl. But Emma tried her best to fill that role and became an expert marksman.
And she actually was in Company F, 2nd Michigan Infantry.
Yes. And, the other part of that research, too, was figuring out how did she get away with this among her fellow soldiers? How did they not notice? They're sleeping in close quarters. They're with each other all day long. And I came to the conclusion that the main reason is that nobody knew what a woman would look like wearing pants. They're so used to seeing their bodies pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes with corsets that the very idea of a woman wearing pants was unfathomable.
Now, so Emma Edmondson. She's the soldier in your title, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy.
Well, I think that they were all soldiers in their own way, but she was actually a literal soldier, yes.
Okay. And was she ever found out? What did she do during the war?
Well, she had quite a few adventures. Her main fear in the beginning was that she didn't want to be discovered. If her gender was discovered, she could be arrested and charged with prostitution and get kicked out of the war, which would have been the absolute worst fate for her because she was such an adventuress and wanted to fight. She really believed in the cause. There was a kink thrown into all of that when she unexpectedly fell in love with a fellow Union soldier and wrestled with a decision. Did she hide her feelings? Did she suffer in silence? Or did she risk everything and tell him who and what she really was? So that was the first hurdle she had to get past.
I'm sorry. I'm seeing Scarlett Johansson here. I'm seeing a movie. I'm sorry. I'm seeing
you and
a movie.
Me both.
Good for you, Karen. If that happens, come back and visit us, okay?
But, definitely.
I mean, this is great. I'm trying to imagine this. Emma Edmondson in uniform, posing as a guy, as Frank Thompson, falling in love with Jerome Robbins, who was a great great choreographer, by the way. No, I'm kidding. This Jerome Robbins was the fellow soldier. So what did she do about this infatuation?
Well, comes a point when she decides that she has to share her secret with him. And it was a great risk for her because if he exposed her, all of those things that I listed could happen. And he was also putting himself at great risk. If they knew that he was sort of aiding and abetting her, he could get in trouble as well. So she, takes that leap. It was something that plays out throughout the book.
Now, at some point, she was fired upon. She was actually in battle.
Yeah, she was on the front lines of a lot of battles. She was operating mostly as a nurse. So she would run out into the battlefield and help drag wounded soldiers off and bring them to the surgery area. And she also served as a courier, delivering messages between generals during battle, and frequently was on the front lines and experienced, you know, many close calls on that.
Hmm. Now, was Emma ever a spy? Did she ever serve as a spy?
She did. There was a point when a Union spy was executed, and she was tapped to take his place. And she was, you know, already a master of deception in that she was fooling everybody into thinking she was a man. So I think that the role of spy is something that came quite easy for her.
You know, I noticed a couple of the women that you write about in the book wrote books themselves. They had memoirs published. Am I correct about that?
Yes. Fortunately, there was a lot of primary source material I could draw from, and you know, was also able to cooperate their memoirs with other sources. Elizabeth Van Loo, who was the Richmond spy working for the Union, her papers are at the New York Public Library, and for a time she even had to bury them because she was so afraid of Confederate officials discovering them, and she would fear of being executed. But they all did write memoirs and diaries.
And Emma was one of them, as you say. And actually, she did pretty well, according to the book. Her memoir sold, 175,000 copies. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that she knew how to play to her audience and shared some of her incredible adventures, and everybody was fascinated by it. But she gave all of the proceeds to Union causes.
So did she manage to go through the entire war without being found out as a woman?
Well, she runs into some difficulties on that front. Namely, she contracts malaria at one point and is terrified of going to the doctor. If she goes back to the doctor, there was no telling whether or not they would conduct a more thorough physical examination than they had just to pass her into the army. And she had to hide her illnesses and try to hope that she healed on her own.
And you followed all of the women, the four women in the book, after the war as well. This book isn't just about their service during the Civil War. What became of Emma Edmondson, Karen?
Well, she leaves the army at one point and eventually starts lobbying to get herself a pension, which was an unorthodox and very brave thing for her to do. After the war, the United States government still, for many years, refused to admit the fact that women served as men in their army, and they were really reluctant to admit that. And she had to go through quite some rigorous lobbying to get some attention for her cause and to get a pension.
She did get it. So she managed to prove that she was Frank Thompson.
She eventually did manage. Yes, she got in touch with a lot of her old comrades, a lot of whom were shocked by the news that she was actually a woman, and then they rallied behind her.
I'm curious. Did you, in doing your research for the book, and just on Emma, because we'll talk about the other women during the course of the hour? Did she become a celebrity? Did people like the story of Emma Edmondson? How did people react when they found out that women had posed as guys in the Union Army, served as spies?
Well, you know, during the war, and this is what makes it so odd that the United States government refused to admit it for so long. You know, during the war, there were stories leaking that women were fighting, and they would be discovered in sometimes really humorous ways. There was one woman disguised as a man. Her captain threw an apple at her, and she grabbed for the hem of her non-existent apron trying to catch it. And just that quick motion of trying to catch something with her apron gave her away. There was another female soldier who forgot how to pull on pants and tried to put them on by pulling them over her head. And in another really great example, there was a corporal.
Giveaway. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And the last one, here's the best dead giveaway. There was a corporal in New Jersey who actually gave birth while she was on picket duty.
Well, that would do it. Yeah,
the jig was up at that point.
Yeah, pick that up for me, dear, would you? I'm sorry. Boy, this is funny. I'm seeing a movie here. I don't know. Everybody else in the audience seeing a movie here? All right.
The film rights were bought, so
really?
Knock on wood.
Oh,
yeah.
Good for you. We're gonna do some casting while we listen to your stories in this hour. By the way, you went to Atlanta, the home of Margaret Mitchell, right?
Yes. Yeah. I was there for 6 years.
Some inspiration down there. Listen, Karen, we have to take our first break. We'll come back and talk some more. We'll talk about the other women in your book, including one who had some Maryland roots. Liar, temptress, soldier, spy. Four women undercover in the Civil War. Good stuff from Karen Abbott, our guest in this hour of midday. Dan Roderick's here. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday and our conversation with Karen Abbott, author of a new book about women in the Civil War, four women undercover in the Civil War. The title is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. And just a couple of things to follow up on our conversation before the break, Karen, about Emma. First question, the infatuation with the fellow soldier, Jerome Robbins, did anything ever come of that?
Well, Jerome had a sweetheart back in Michigan, and he would unknowingly torture Emma with, talking about her letters and how excited he was to go on furlough and maybe go see her. And I think that's partly what prompted Emma to step up and say, hey, I'm here and I'm a woman and I like you.
Yeah.
They do a sort of interesting dance throughout the book. Jerome isn't sure he wants to be with Emma, but he also doesn't want to lose her affections.
I want to move on now to Rose O'Neill Greenhow. I wonder if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. It's G-R-E-E-N-H-O, just as it looks, Greenhow.
Yeah.
Now, this is on the other side. This is a Confederate sympathizer, but originally from Maryland. You pick up the story with her in Washington, right?
Yes. But she does have Maryland roots, and I think that her childhood was really important in, who she became and her loyalties and her affections and for the South. She grew up on a plantation, and at a very young age, I think she was about 4 years old, her father was murdered by his slave. And I think that left quite an impression on her, even if she and it's something that she really didn't like to discuss, I think.
Well, let's talk about her a little bit. She's in Washington, and when you pick up the story, and the Civil War breaks out, how old is she?
She's in her 40s. She's about 41 or 42, and, her whole life had fallen apart in the years leading up to the war. She had lost 5 children in 4 years, if you can imagine that. She lost her husband in a freak accident. And she lost her access to the White House. She's somebody who had been friends with high-ranking Democratic politicians for decades leading up to the war. She'd even served as an advisor to President James Buchanan. And she lost all of that when Lincoln and the Republicans came into power. And she was really desperate to get her old life back, or even a piece of it back. So in the spring of 1861, when a Confederate captain approached her and asked her if she wanted to run a Confederate ring in the Union capital, Washington, D.C., she jumps at the chance and begins cultivating sources. And by cultivating, I really mean seducing. And one of her most important sources was a Massachusetts senator by the name of Senator Henry Wilson, who was an abolitionist Republican and also Lincoln's chairman for the Committee on Military Affairs. So you can imagine that they had some very interesting and for her, lucrative pillow talk.
Wow. That's a notable conquest. The chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs, Henry Wilson, also a future vice president.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she knew what she had to do as far as espionage went. She had to gain the affections of men in power, men who knew things.
She did, and she was very skilled at that. She was a skilled seductress, and definitely one of the temptresses in the title, fits her to a T. And she also had to learn the mechanics of espionage. The Confederate captain who approached her gave her a cipher, which she had to memorize and practice. And she also learned Morse code, and I thought this was really fascinating. If she didn't have time to write an enciphered dispatch, she could raise and lower her blinds to indicate certain dots and dashes on the Morse code, and Confederate operatives would watch for her signals. And she also did the same thing with her fan. She would flutter it very precisely to indicate dots and dashes so that if one of her scouts was watching, they would be able to pick up her message that way.
Wow. So she was pretty good then. She was effective. Can you just give us an example of how effective she was? What did she manage to help the Confederates with?
Sure. I should preface this by saying that the Union and Lincoln and most people in the North believed that the war was going to be over in 90 days. It was going to be a quick war. They were going to meet the Confederates at the First Battle of Bull Run, Manassas in the South, and then march on to Richmond and capture Richmond, and it would all be over. But Rose Greenhough and the Confederates had a different idea. And in the weeks leading up to the Battle of Bull Run, you know, after Rose gathered her intelligence from Senator Henry Wilson and various other lovers, she summoned a 16-year-old courier to her home, a girl by the name of Betty Duvall. And Rose had an enciphered dispatch that contained information about the Union forces' plans for the First Battle of Bull Run, when they were going to march and how many. And she wrapped up this dispatch into Betty's hair and coiled it inside, made a bun, and told Betty to go on to Confederate headquarters and just pretend she was a simple farm girl on her way home from the market. And nobody would suspect a thing. And so Betty did exactly this. And she makes her way to Confederate headquarters, lets down her hair, produces this enciphered dispatch containing information about Bull Run. And the Confederates were ready at Bull Run then. It was a crucial piece of information they needed just to prepare themselves. And, of course, they beat the Union in a shocking defeat at Bull Run.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think of it until just now when you described Betty Duvall's bun, is that women who chose to operate as spies and needed to hide things, right, had plenty of places to hide things on their on their person, right? They wore these hoop skirts, and there were social mores at the time would prevent men from doing certain things in terms of a search, I suppose, if they were suspected. But they could stick things in their hair, right?
Absolutely. You know, it was really fascinating to me to see how they use their gender as both a physical and psychological disguise. You know, physically, they're hiding dispatches in their hair. They're hiding guns and weaponry in their hoop skirts, various things that they smuggled across the lines using their clothing. And nobody, as you said, you know, thought that it was proper or appropriate to inspect them, even if they did suspect treasonous activity. And psychologically, you know, if somebody did question them and accuse them of such behavior, the usual response was, you know, how dare you to suggest I'm doing these things is beneath the conduct of an officer and a gentleman. How dare you? I am a defenseless woman.
Right.
You know, I'm a defenseless woman. And, of course, none of them were defenseless women. So it was quite a brilliant strategy on their part.
Now, what happened to Rose? Rose O'Neill Greenhough. Before you tell us what happened, I have this question. Wasn't she known to be a Confederate sympathizer? I mean, when you're talking about the Senator Henry Wilson, Calhoun, the former vice president, defender of slavery, these men that she knew in the Capitol, didn't they know where her loyalties lay?
They did. And, you know, she had been friends. And when I say friends, I mean in a social context. She would have dinner parties and she would invite both Democrats and Republicans. I think she was somebody who genuinely enjoyed talking politics. And men were sort of amazed by her because, number one, she was considered a very beautiful woman. And number two, she was exceptionally smart. But still, the stigma against women not being, you know, fully aware of political philosophy played in her favor. When she was on trial, she was at a hearing where people were accusing her of fighting for the Confederacy and spying for the Confederacy. And she defended herself very brilliantly. And she also asked for all of her papers back. They had seized all of her paperwork, and she asked for her papers back. And I'll never forget this line. One of her accusers said, "Well, you know, I think that it would be okay for us to give you your papers back because you weren't intent on anything more than mischief." So here she
not giving her credit, not giving her credit for what she was actually doing, right?
Exactly.
Not believing it possible.
Right, exactly. And I think she was really offended by this downgrade of her contributions, you know, mischief. I just helped the Confederates win the First Battle of Bull Run. You're accusing me of mischief. But you're right. They did not. It was unthinkable that women were capable of this sort of activity, you know, let alone executing it more deftly than men.
Now, did they keep a woman in jail for this?
Rose did spend some time in jail, you know, she did not crack. They tortured her, I think, in every way that it was possible for you to torture a woman back in the 1860s, and waited for her to crack and reveal her sources and admit her behavior. And she was very sort of steadfastly strong-willed and refused to crack under pressure.
Was there ever any ramification for the men she had conquered?
They did some investigation. You know, Henry Wilson was called in for questioning, but I guess that the fact that they were dismissing Rose's contributions played in his favor because, as you said earlier, he went on to become the vice president.
Right. I wanted to ask you about another man whose name comes up in the Civil War, Alan Pinkerton.
Yes.
And I wonder, did he play a role in any of these stories that are in your book, Karen?
He did. And I love that the famous detective Alan Pinkerton makes a pretty large cameo here, actually. He was hired by the Union Army to do some Secret Service work, and his very first assignment was to conduct a stakeout on Rose Greenhow. So there's a great scene where Pinkerton and two of his detectives go stake out her house, which is on Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., and he stands on his detective's shoulders just to get a peek into her front window. And what does he see but Rose Greenhow and a Union captain sitting on her couch, looking over maps and fortifications and clearly discussing military strategy. And then they start furiously kissing, passionate kissing. And Pinkerton's just enraged and declares, you know, Rose public enemy number one and goes after her in a very targeted way.
What's her name? Jennifer from Hunger Games. What's her last name?
Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get Rose O'Neill Greenhow as Jennifer Lawrence plays that part. Who plays Pinkerton? Karen?
Oh, that's a good question. Huh? Kyle MacLachlan.
Kevin Spacey? How about Spacey?
Oh, Spacey would be good, too, the House of Cards connection.
Yeah. So far we've got Scarlett Johansson as Emma Edmondson, and now we've got Jennifer Lawrence as Rose Greenhow and Kevin Spacey as Pinkerton. But this is real stuff.
I like that.
This actually is based on the real thing. This is a nonfiction book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Our guest is Karen Abbott, its author. Just a little bit more on Rose. She's fascinating. Of the four women you profiled in the book, would you say she became the most famous?
I think that it's a toss-up. I've heard various things about people had heard of one and not the other. But Rose, I think, was among the most famous, mostly because she was very outspoken. And she wrote not only a memoir about her time in prison and her activities in Washington, D.C., but she also wrote a diary about her trip to Europe. She was sent to Europe to lobby on behalf of the Confederacy and to try to convince England and France that they should recognize the South as a legitimate separate government. And as you can imagine, she had several interesting adventures while she was abroad.
Well, this is very interesting. She was actually released from prison. And they told her, just don't come back here, right? So she went south, yeah. and Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, actually appointed her to a position and sent her to Europe.
Exactly. It was an unprecedented move. I think it was the first time that an American president, North or South, but first time an American president sent a woman to an official diplomatic capacity on behalf of his government.
Well, think about that for a minute. That's pretty extraordinary for 1863, appointed emissary to the court in France and Great Britain.
Yeah, and she met with royalty and several dignities over there, the diary is really fascinating, and I chronicle this in the book, how, you know, she shows her increasing frustrations with the fact that they sympathize with the South. A lot of them thought the North was barbaric. But they couldn't quite pull the trigger in supporting the Confederacy because they were afraid of angering the North.
Do you know if she tried to use her, how should I put this?
Female persuasions, her feminine wiles.
Powers of female persuasion on the British or the French, do you know?
Oh, she did. She had a couple dalliances over there, and one of them was with a British politician who was instrumental in deciding their political the way that they would side with the war. She tried to lobby him as best she could. It took several carriage rides alone with him and tried to sway him as best she could, and again ran into some difficulty. And then she eventually, I think, gave up on that and just went after this beautiful 25-year-old Confederate soldier who had been captured and was over in England.
When you step back from this a little bit, because you've been researching this a while and you wrote this book. So you've been immersed in this for what? How many years now?
Five years,
Karen. When you step back from it a little bit, and you realize these are true stories. This actually happened. These women actually did these things. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary, really. It took a lot of courage, a lot of brass to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would every time I went through the nonfiction material and the source material, I couldn't believe that this is what I had to work with, that these were their true stories. And I guess, you know, war is inherently leads to some interesting situations and also just attracts interesting characters. And it was just a great serendipity that their stories all touched in a way that made sense to me. It was important to me that they all wove a tapestry that, you know, one woman's actions might affect another woman's circumstances. And you could weave those together in a way to tell the story of the war in a way it hadn't been told before.
Some stories get exaggerated. But I guess as a historian, you have to work to see if can you validate, can you confirm some of these stories elsewhere with secondary sources?
I did, and I explicitly stated in the beginning that if the women engage in the time-honored tradition of Civil War self-mythology, I would discuss it either in the text or in the endnotes. And I do that quite a bit with them, especially with Emma Edmonds, and was able to make the case that while some people dismissed her claims of being a spy, there were other sources that indicate it's likely and quite possible that she did go undercover several times. So I was able to dig up the primary sources that supported that.
We're going to take another break here, come back and talk some more. Okay, Karen?
Sure.
Yeah. Karen Abbott, our guest this hour of the show, her book published by Harper is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. When we get back, another profile, a woman from who sympathized with the Union side, another one from the South. We'll be right back for more Midday. Welcome back to Midday. Of the four women, are any of them memorialized anywhere, sort of, held up as a heroine, a plaque, a statue, the answer to a trivia question, any place?
Actually, yes. I spent some time in the Shenandoah Valley, which was the home of Belle Boyd, who was my other Confederate spy. And there's a plaque there commemorating the Battle of Front Royal in the spring of 1862, when she ran into the battlefield, you know, dodging bullets and risking her life to deliver a message to Stonewall Jackson, who she was not only interested in, just because he was the famous Confederate general. She had a little bit of a weird romantic interest in him, too. She was quite obsessed with him.
We're going to talk about Belle Boyd now. Beautiful name for a woman of that era, Belle Boyd. But I love this quote, is what she tells her cousin at some point when they're talking about her appearance. She says, "My form is beautiful. My eyes are of a dark blue and so expressive. My hair of a rich brown, and I think I tie it up nicely. My neck and arms are beautiful, and my foot is perfect." Which foot?
That's actually my favorite quote in the whole book.
It's great. I was just wondering which foot she's talking about. So,
right, the other one is full of flaws.
There are photographs of the women in the book, and there's a photograph of Belle that we found, or you found, in the Library of Congress. Belle Boyd, Confederate spy. Of course, I think this photograph was taken sometime after the Civil War, but. So when she talks about herself that way, and how do other people describe her appearance? Because one assumes if you're going to be a spy and seduce men who know things for the other side, you know, you got to have a little, something going on there. So where do we fall down on with Belle Boyd in terms of her appearance compared to other women at the time?
Well, men... often commented that she and were amazed that she would wander through camps and men would sort of flock to her and fall all over her and hang on every word.
There you
go. And one soldier said she did all of this, quote, without being beautiful.
Huh?
There were comments about her horsey teeth and her mouth and just that she was sort of a crude woman. But I think that she must have been incredibly charismatic, and she was also very bold for the era. She was really overt with both her opinions and her sexuality. I like to say that she, if Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th century baby, it would have been
Belle Boyd. Okay.
So, yeah.
We're still working on the casting for your movie, Karen. Extremely flirtatious, according to your research. And that foot was perfect. So maybe that's what turned some guys on. Anyway, I'm sorry, what'd you want to say?
Oh, I just was, you know, the men loved her. The women, it was a different story. She had one teenage rival. I thought this was a great quote, too, who called her, quote, the fastest girl in Virginia, or anywhere else for that matter.
And she was from Virginia, you just say here, the Shenandoah Valley. So we assume that her heart was with the Confederacy.
Absolutely. And I don't think that Belle, you know, she wasn't an avid proponent of slavery. She had her personal slave, and she taught her to read and write, which was against the law at the time in the South, and was quite affectionate with her. It was a mutual affection. But she had a lot of relatives in the Confederate Army. And, you know, this is important. She was only 17 years old. So she just sort of was influenced by her family's positions, and I think she thought that this was a way for her to get some adventure in her life too. She was always seeking adventure, and what better way than to become a courier and spy for the Confederate Army?
Was there any slavery in her family?
Yes, they did. They owned a plantation, and there were a team of slaves, and there were also some house slaves. I believe there were five that were living with her at the beginning of the war. So there was slavery. And Belle said that she wrote in her own book that she thinks slavery, you know, that the time would come to end it, but now wasn't the time. So, and I'm sure that was something that was, you know, she's just parroting back from something her mother said.
Hmm. It sounds from her personality, even given her age, that she wouldn't be content supporting the war from the home front, you know, sewing uniforms or raising money for supplies. So what did she do about that? She had an ambition to do more.
Well, Belle kicks things off in July of 1861. It's the 4th of July, and Union forces were marching down to the Shenandoah Valley, and they had just won a skirmish, and they were planning a big celebration, 4th of July celebration in her hometown. And they arrive and they start stealing liquor and breaking into stores and breaking into homes and generally wrecking havoc. And one of the soldiers comes to Belle Boyd's house and threatens to raise a Union flag over her house. And Belle, you know, being the cool, calm, and collected sort, decides to shoot this fellow dead. And she gets away with it. She claims self-defense and she gets away with it. And I think she was really emboldened by that. She figured she can get away with anything and decides to become a courier and spy for the Confederate Army and really sets her sights also on Stonewall Jackson, the famous Confederate general.
Well, yeah, you touched on him before. So he's a rather large figure in her eyes. And does she actually serve him as a spy directly?
Well, she her goal is to just get him to notice her. And Stonewall was a very strange character. You know, he was sort of a Civil War era rock star. If the Civil War had a rock star, it was Stonewall Jackson. And there was a great scene where he's, you know, in 1862, when he's in a Shenandoah Valley hotel lobby, and the women are swarming him. They're descending upon him. They're ripping buttons off his coat. They're keeping them for souvenirs. And Stonewall takes a step back and says, ladies, I think this was the very first time I've been surrounded by the enemy. and Belle makes this bold declaration that she wants to, quote, occupy his tent and share his dangers, which I think if I were Stonewall Jackson would have frightened me more than anything the Union Army had in store. You know, the fact that Belle Boyd wanted to occupy my tent.
What did she actually do then that made her a spy?
She would smuggle things across the lines. She also smuggled dispatches. She would deliver messages between generals. She also, there was a great scene where she eavesdrops on a war council. Union forces often occupied her hometown in the Shenandoah Valley. The town switched hands quite often. And a few of them stayed at her aunt's hotel where she decided to make her own little headquarters. And one night the Union officials had a war council, and Belle, you know, literally presses her ear to the floor and picks up information from this war council. And that's part of what leads her to give that message to Stonewall Jackson at the Battle of Front Royal that let the Confederates win that battle.
So Belle Boyd, as far as you know, never dressed as a man, never put on a disguise as a soldier?
There were some occasions where Belle did dress as a man. If she was doing courier work, she often dressed as a man.
Oh.
And she also, you know, had a habit of putting on Confederate garb. She would take buttons and souvenirs and pin them all over her coat. And she would wear, you know, general sashes. And I think she really fancied the idea of dressing up like a Confederate general.
The reason I ask about dress for in her case is because when you describe her, transporting messages across lines, it sounds like a lot of what would be considered spying or espionage in the Civil War was simply that, just, you know, carrying messages from one place to another, picking up information, delivering it across the line. So actually, you know, having to use stealth to avoid encounters with the enemy. If you were dressed like a woman, maybe, that serves as your cover, because how many soldiers are going to suspect a woman that they see walking down a road somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. And she definitely used that to her advantage. And she sort of ties into that whole we were discussing earlier about hoop skirts. Mm-hmm. Belle was sort of the queen of smuggling. And she would go around the Union camps at night and collect unattended sabers and pistols and tie them to her hoop skirts. And she would lead a bunch of other Confederate ladies in this enterprise. And I think it was the 28th Pennsylvania Regiment that one day woke up to find that they were missing about 400 sabers, 1,200 pistols, cavalry equipment for 800
wow.
men. It was all waiting for transfer to the Southern lines. So she occupied herself by doing that quite often.
Well, that's pretty good. But so, Karen, I wanted to ask you, of all the women, the four women that you profile in the book, and we'll talk about Elizabeth Van Loo in a moment, did any of them do one particular thing that turned the, I don't want to use the cliche, turned the tide, but, you know, made the difference in a battle, made the difference in some decision a general might have made?
I think that, Rose did have the first Battle of Bull Run, which was her great coup in terms of turning a battle. But I think the most effective spy in history would agree that it was Elizabeth Van Loo, the last spy. She was a Union spy living in the Confederate capital of Richmond and was quite an interesting character. You know, she was sort of the opposite of Rose Greenhow. Rose was bold and audacious and very outspoken. And Elizabeth was really quiet and deftly cunning. And she was an abolitionist, which was a very dangerous position for her to hold after the war broke out. And she would receive death threats. Confederate detectives followed her everywhere. But nevertheless, she decided to form a Union espionage ring in Richmond and put her life on the line every day doing that, and was really incredibly effective.
This is Elizabeth Van Loo. That's V-A-N and then a separate name, L-E-W. You say of her, Richmond society had always tolerated her, partly because of her father's legacy as a prominent businessman and slave owner, and partly because she was perceived as a benign oddity, an eccentric old spinster destined to die alone in her house on the hill.
Yeah, she, it was a very dangerous position for her to hold after the war, and people always thought she was odd. But after the war broke out, it was an entirely different playing field, and she really had to watch her step. People were trying to entrap her. People were following her. And she nevertheless takes this great risk. She sends one of her former family slaves to the Confederate White House to be a spy. This was a remarkable woman by the name of Mary Jane Bowser. And Elizabeth had freed her. She was born as slavery into Elizabeth's family. Elizabeth freed her when she was a young girl and decided that she would, you know, help her in her espionage ring. And so she answers Verena Davis's call, Verena Davis being the first lady of the Confederacy, who when she said she needed to staff the White House. And Elizabeth pays her a social visit and says, well, I have a girl for you. She's not very bright, and she stumbles in the kitchen, but she'll serve your purposes. And so Elizabeth sends Mary Jane Bowser over to work in the Confederate White House. And nobody knows that Mary Jane Bowser is not only literate, but highly educated and gifted with a photographic memory. So while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk and picking up the children's toys, she's also sneaking peeks at maps and letters on his desk and eavesdropping on confidential conversations he's having with his advisors and reporting all of this back to Elizabeth.
That's amazing. That's a great story. You got to make a movie out of this. I want to see this movie.
Hillary Swank for Elizabeth,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
For Elizabeth Van Loo, Hillary Swank. And then you got the cast, Mary Jane Bowser. This is Mary Jane Bowser's story alone is a great story.
So she's, oh, it is.
She's in there cleaning up the president of the Confederacy's office. She's looking at maps and things like that.
Yeah, and they devised a really interesting system to sort of convey the information. You know, Mary Jane would hang up a certain color shirt on the line, which would indicate that she had something to deliver. And they recruited the seamstress. It was an abolitionist seamstress who was a friend's worked for a family friend of Elizabeth's. And Mary Jane Bowser would take write up her dispatches and sew them into Verena Davis's dresses and bring these dresses to the seamstress, quote unquote, for repair. But meanwhile, the seamstress would just get the dispatches out and send them over to Elizabeth. So they had a little chain relay system for their delivery of dispatches.
This is a great story. One last question about Elizabeth Van Loo, because we're getting short of time, unfortunately. But when you said she was an abolitionist living in Richmond, in Richmond society, where did that come from? What did you study about her past that would suggest that she, developed a view, such a strong view against slavery?
Well, she was born in Richmond, but her parents, who were both from the North, sent her to Philadelphia to be educated. And while she was there, she was under the care of an abolitionist governess. And so when she finished her schooling and she came back to Richmond, her years up north really affected her. She used to go around to the slave auctions at Richmond and just weep. After her father died, she defied his wishes and freed all the family slaves. And she also began spending her considerable inheritance buying slaves just for the express purpose of freeing them. So these were opinions that were deeply held with her, and she wrote often in her diary about the cruelties of slavery.
Wow, what a great story. They're all good, Karen. Boy, you really stumbled upon something terrific here, huh? You feel like you
hit... I had fun with them.
Yeah, and they wrote about their experiences. One of our listeners wrote in an email wondering, you know, how did you do your research and find out all this information? It did help that these women told their stories after the war and wrote them down.
Oh, it definitely helped. And it also helped that there's just, endless volumes of information about the Civil War. I did a lot of digging into just the mechanics of espionage and what the ciphers were like and how they devised those and how they used them. And I actually had a CIA codebreaker, a retired CIA codebreaker, vet the manuscript. And he gave me also some really interesting insights into how espionage worked and how it evolved during the Civil War.
Was Elizabeth Van Loo ever recognized by our government, the federal government, for what she did?
Well, Elizabeth Van Loo ends up becoming Ulysses S. Grant's primary spy. I do not think the Union would have won the war without Elizabeth Van Loo. I mean, that's how vital she was. Afterwards, she stayed in Richmond. And you can imagine that Richmond was not very pleased with her once they knew what she had done. And Ulysses S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant appointed her to a position, but I don't think she was ever compensated in the way that she deserved to be compensated or in the way that she wanted to be compensated.
Actually, I don't have to imagine. I can read the rest of your book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Karen, I really enjoyed this. Congratulations on this research and this book. And all the kidding aside about the movie, I do hope it happens because there's some great material here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope so, too. Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
Yeah, sure. Karen Abbott, author of Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. That book is published by Harper. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I have to read the rest of that book. Listen, everybody, have a great afternoon. Thanks for tuning in to Midday. We'll see you again soon.